You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Vichet Chum. Vichet is a friend of mine from the University of Evansville. He is such a talented artist and one of the warmest, most open-hearted guys that I know. I'm thrilled to have him chat here with me about pursuing a life in the arts. I hope you enjoy the sixth episode of The Compass. Hi.
Hello.
I'm so glad you're over at my house.
Thanks. I'm glad I'm here.
So what do you do to keep yourself from going to the dark side as an artist?
Oh. So many things. Primarily, I try to work. I try to lean into what's scary and try to lean into working more and using my restlessness and my angst and my fears and my anxieties to be productive. Being productive makes me not as scared because I feel like I can control it. Now that's my first response, but then there are also other things because I'm not always so productive. I try to socialize. I try to surround myself with people that I love and I care about.
That's important.
Yeah. People who take me to, who force me to go outside and to breathe and to look around and to drink a beer and to go to a museum or to do anything besides thinking about the things that are bad.
Yeah. Is that what the dark side looks like for you? Is it kind of isolating yourself and getting in your head about...
Yeah, I've been thinking about this question. I mean, I feel a little guilty that I've now listened to the entire podcast of The Compass. And so I feel like I've, you know, listened to other people's dark sides and mine's not all too different from that. But yeah. I know my version of the dark side is isolation and is feeling real sorry for myself and choosing to not, also being self-aware of my struggle and not wanting to burden other people with my own troubles. I often have a problem with feeling like, well, I already know it's ridiculous that I feel this way.
Right.
And so I often will choose or make a choice to stay by myself so I won't have to burden other people or whatnot. But I do find I was totally enlightened and totally connected with Brendan's response about once you talk about it, it actually feels less awful.
Yeah.
And it feels less important in a lot of ways. So I've actually made more of a concerted effort to actually talk about it. So it doesn't, it's not something that is internalized within me and eats me up.
Yeah. That is hard though, when you're aware of the fact that I shouldn't be feeling this way, or I shouldn't be comparing myself, or I shouldn't be.
Oh, for sure.
I know it's silly, but I'm doing it. You still feel it.
Yeah, well, and that's a hard thing because I think I've always had a difficult time expressing the things that make the bad things.
Right.
You know, the things that feel like, and I think that comes from my upbringing. I think, you know, I was sort of surrounded by people who had been through a lot, you know, in their lives, and so there was this kind of expectation that what you are going through is probably not as bad.
Yeah.
So I think that for me, I felt guilty and bad about expressing those things. But I think I've over in my adulthood, I've sort of come to this other place where I've realized that it is your life and it is the things that you are reckoning with and your fears and anxieties about your career and about your artistic life. And this job, this career is hella scary, and mm-hmm. and living it is hard. And I think that being in New York and being out of graduate school and all that stuff has, in the last couple of years, I've really started to understand, no, you can own that pain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you
I
can,
do, I do.
You can absolutely, you have to own it to be better and to move past it, you know?
So. Yeah, I've dealt with the same thing of feeling like, oh, I'm feeling this way, but yeah. You know, there are people experiencing much, much, much yeah. worse
yeah.
circumstances.
Yeah, and sometimes that's
but it's still true that yeah. you're having a hard time.
Yeah, and the more you just push yourself to say other people are having a worse time than you, the less you're actually dealing with your own stuff. And it internalizes and it gets bigger and it gets worse. And you kind of just have to face it, even if it's gross and even if it makes you feel really terribly gross. You have to kind of look it in the eye and say, yeah, I'm feeling really stupid and dissatisfied with my career. Because I think once you talk about it and once you hear other people go through it, you're like, oh, okay, I'm in a community of people who are going through the same things. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you say that you try to work
yeah.
to take yourself out of that place,
yeah.
how does that manifest for you?
It manifests itself. I'm laughing because.
Or what ways have you found to have it manifest? If you're not cast in a play right then.
Sure.
How do you work on your own?
Yeah. So, you know, in graduate school, I had. I went to Brown, obviously, mm-hmm. and a lot of the curriculum is based in this idea that acting is not too far from directing, which is not too far from writing, which is not too far from any of the jobs that you do in the creative sphere of theater. And so we had to take directing and playwriting classes while we were doing acting classes. And I kind of, during that time, I sort of brushed it off like, oh, I'm going to be an actor.
Right.
Because that's what you think the life is, right? But I think towards the end of graduate school, I started to more seriously do writing and directing. And then I didn't really understand what they were talking about until I got out of school and was pushed into New York City and pushed into adulthood. And pushed into looking at my career and thinking, what do I do? Like, what should I do? What can I do?
Yeah.
And so when it got really dark, I mean, I think back to the time when I worked at this hotel. I worked the graveyard shifts at this hotel in the Lower East Side. It was called the Hotel East Houston. And I would work from the hours of 11 p.m. to 7 a.m.
Whoa.
And so I would sit there all night at the front desk and just stare into space. And there's nothing more despairing as an artist than just having time, right?
And I'm sure you weren't allowed to do anything else.
Yeah, I mean, technically. Because, I mean, I obviously cheated a lot. we were supposed to be standing at all times. We were supposed to... The TV was supposed to be off. We were supposed to just be present all night long. Lies. back to your question, I would take out my laptop just mm-hmm. blatantly because it was like 2 a.m. in the morning.
Who's there checking at 2 a.m.?
On a Wednesday, nobody. So I would pull out my laptop and just stare at like an empty Microsoft Word document and just go, what do you have to say for yourself? Because it's, you know, it's half of the writing. Actually, I think most of the difficulty in creating a writing is just disciplining yourself and making yourself stare at the blankness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I think working or leaning into the work, it was about, it came out of my fear and it came out of my, what am I about and what do I want to do? And so even now when I'm feeling pretty low, and I've had some pretty low moments, I sometimes will just open up my laptop or, I don't know, just open up my journal or just go for a walk or seek out a specific kind of movie or something,
mm-hmm.
just to like seek out some sort of inspiration for something. And then sometimes I don't, you know, I think that I try really hard. And sometimes I sit there and I just look at it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's like an hour and a half later and I've written like, my name is Vichet Cham and that's it. But, you know, for me.
But you still made the effort to put yourself in that space.
Yeah. Because maybe the more I do it, maybe something will come out of it. And some pretty cool stuff has come out of it. I have realized that in this business, in this career, it is about figuring out what kind of work you want to do, and what you care about. You know, I think you sometimes hear that question, what is your type as an actor, a lot. And how do you, I don't know, endorse yourself or how do you sell yourself or whatever.
Right. I feel like that's a different question though.
Yeah. For sure. And I think that the question that I've tried to hone in on is like, what is your story? Because I think that is more true to just like who we are as people and why we got into the arts to begin with, because we felt like there was something that we wanted to say or something that we felt was really important or propelled us to do this crazy ass thing.
Something that you had to offer.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember being a kid and being really shy and not being the first person to ever talk, just like being like maybe the fourth or the fifth person, but watching what the other kids were doing and feeling, and still feeling like there was so much going on inside of me that I needed to say something at some point, but I was going to wait it out until somebody else did. And I think there's something about that is an artist's life. You know, there's this need, there's the combination of brewing and thinking about the thing that you want to express and then getting to the moment of expressing it, you know? And I don't know. I think that's something that I'm trying to harness and calibrate. And
you're circling what that is.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, I know that part of how you've kind of found an outlet is you've been working on like a one-man show over the years.
My one-man show. Yes.
Which is, I think, is amazing and brave, and it's something that I would love to tackle at some point because I find it so scary.
Yeah.
What stage are you at with that right now?
Oh, it's so interesting. I actually did not expect that you were going to ask me that question for some reason, but now it feels so obvious.
No, because it's something you've found by yourself.
Yeah.
An outlet that you've found that you could do alone.
Yeah, so.
Or at least begin alone.
Mm-hmm. So the show definitely started by myself. The show is about, I mean, it's funny that I set it up in such a way, because the show is about a young-ish Cambodian guy who works at a hotel in New York City. Surprise!
I forgot that in the show he worked at a hotel. Okay.
Yeah, who essentially, he's reckoning with his parents' legacy of tragedy and survival because they survived the genocide in Cambodia, and his own need to be whoever he's going to be, right? It's not autobiographical at all. But anyway, so I actually, also in the play, the character is studying Khmer, the Cambodian language, for the first time.
Okay.
In preparation for a trip to Cambodia for the first time. So,
have you been to Cambodia?
I haven't. Okay. It is like a storm cloud, just right there. But the show kind of began, show did begin with me going to this language intensive in Madison, Wisconsin, randomly after my second year of graduate school. Actually, my first year, I apologize. Because I wanted to talk to my parents. Because I grew up hearing the language a lot, but my parents never pressured me to learn it in a more formal way. Mm-hmm. So I understand it okay, but I had a real difficulty. I have a real difficulty speaking it.
Why Wisconsin? Was that just, is so it they're only available in certain
locations, so random. So my cousin attended this language intensive as well, but it's called the Southeast Asian Summer Institute. And so basically, it's multiple Southeast Asian languages at the same time, classes at the same time. And so there are people around me learning Thai, Tagali, and Khmer, and other languages as well. And so that was a really special experience for me. It was really difficult, but I started journaling a lot during that time because I just knew this was like crazy. This experience was crazy because I was learning the language from this like 6'5" white guy.
Really?
Who knew the language better than any other Cambodian that I had ever met in my life. Yeah, he wanted. Yeah, it was crazy. He wanted to learn the language because he fell in love with a Cambodian girl. Love.
All right.
So basically, you know, I went to this language
in
intensive.
The Midwest.
Yeah, I'm in the Midwest. I'm like, what is happening? And I'm learning this language in a very formal way. I'm making like connections from things I've heard in my past. It was just such a unique experience for me, and so I was journaling a ton. And then my third year of graduate school, we had to do these solo performances, our theses or whatever, theses. And we had to do, I guess, 30 minutes of anything. And so I looked at these journal entries and thought, there's something here, something important. And so I started writing in that way, in the kind of solo voice. But it wasn't until I moved to New York and really felt like the despair of being an artist and having too much time and feeling like I wanted to do so much, but I couldn't quite figure it out. And then I had so much time at the hotel that I opened up my laptop and I just wrote. And so I combined that former performance with this new experience of having so much time. And I created this crazy play that really helped me exercise a lot of my demons. And I workshopped the play quite a bit. And then I did a couple of performances at a theater in New York. And then like 2-3 years have passed now, and I'm sort of reexamining what the play is. I think I was for a long time just trying to have somebody host it, take my play and let me do this play because it's ready to go. But I realized that just recently, actually, that I wanted to reexamine the script and I wanted to unlock different things and just see what else I can do theatrically and keeping it closer to my own personal voice. I think I was, in the former iteration, I was trying really hard to get it up on its feet.
Right.
And I think now I'm trying to really kind of hone in on the truth of it.
I'm sure you're in a different place 3 years later too.
Yeah, and looking at the performances that I had and seeing what worked and what didn't work and seeing how much I have changed since then. Cause, you know, I'm inching into my 30s and I certainly feel the despair is loud and clear.
I understand.
it definitely.
Time is a strange thing.
Time is very strange. I saw a picture of myself when I just got out of graduate school and thought, look at that baby. And then thought, what? That was like a couple years ago. But
I know.
It does feel very strange to know how quickly time passes.
Yeah. And we put a artificial timeline on what we imagine.
Oh, for sure.
The very linear ladder of our careers will be after school.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I'll achieve this by this time and this by the... And it'll all obviously lead to the next thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it doesn't. And, you know, I had this unique experience of going back to the University of Evansville.
Yeah?
UE, alma mater.
Where we went to undergrad together.
What? UE? Yeah, I did a show out at Actors Theater,
right.
And then I went back to talk to the students, and it was...
What was that like?
Fascinating, because these kids, I call them kids, but they all look like us, they all feel like us, they sound like us, there's this kind of buoyant, lovely energy about all of them that you just... You can't help but be totally charmed by. But also there's this like feeling of now years have passed since I've been in college and thinking of that responsibility to tell these people something important.
Yeah.
And something about this career. And you know, for a while I thought to myself that I was going to be like that old man who's like... You want to be in the business, kid? Well, sell your soul. But I, being there, I had to calibrate a little bit. But I did feel this need to tell the students that the journey is not linear. And I said it in so many words, but I think it was really important for me to relay that. You will think that if you do A, B, and C, that this is the career or life you think you will have. But it's sometimes not about that, and that's actually not what happens. It's about... This journey feels much more about trying to figure out how to make yourself happy and finding true happiness in whatever space you're in. Because... You can go from A to B to C, and it won't turn out necessarily the way you think it will go. And I don't think that's ultimately it's not negative because it's the truth, right? Or at least I've been trying to convince myself of that. But I think it's just about being ready for the twists and the turns and the surprises and finding joy in spite of the things that are really difficult and yes, working really, really hard for sure. Like work your ass off, but also be ready for life to just take you somewhere else.
That's so hard in our society that so much importance is put on.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
What do you do for a living and
yeah.
your status
yeah.
associated with that? And I think you're right. I think having the instability of that in this career path kind of makes you focus on, am I happy on a more base level?
Yeah.
What am I doing as a human being?
Yeah, for sure.
Outside of owning a house and saving for retirement, because we just don't have that.
Yeah.
Or most people don't.
Yeah. One, I think sometimes you have this feeling as an artist that you're sort of waiting for your life to begin.
Yeah.
or you're waiting for, if I get this or if I get that, then
it's
I can do
waiting.
This other
the
thing.
The waiting is so hard for me.
Yeah. But it's also about just making choices and being unafraid to make choices if it, making choices that might prevent you from doing something else, because you just can't wait for your life to start.
Yeah.
And that's something I've really had to really find out for myself, because I was, I still am, you know, there's still this feeling of like, I'm waiting for certain things to work out before I can move on to this next place. Mm-hmm. But you gotta live your life. It's happening. And then you look back and you go, oh my God, holy shit. It's like 5 years since grad school. What?
What happened?
Yeah. Life is happening like right now.
Yeah.
You know, that's hard to actually understand in real time. It's really hard.
Going back to your solo show, have you shared any of that with your family? Has your family read any of your writing or seen any of the readings?
Hell no.
Has your brother?
My brother has. Your brother my has. Brother...
Who lives in New York.
Yes. My brother, Surya, has been... He saw the performances at the Cherry Lane Theater. And he also saw my first iteration at Brown. And he's been super supportive. And after the Cherry Lane performance, he asked me, or he told me, he encouraged me mm-hmm. to share this with my parents. I think I'm really terrified of sharing it with my parents. Because
do they know it exists and you just
they do.
That you don't want to share it, or they don't know anything?
They know. Okay. So they know of it. Okay. And it's actually funny because after my performance, my last performance in graduate school of this piece, it's sort of this open event. It's this lovely event where all the entire school and theater and parents who are in town, it's close to graduation, but not quite graduation. It's a time when everyone comes and gathers and watches these last performances. So mine was one of those last performances, and a lot of parents saw it. And then graduation followed right after. And so my parents came to town, and a lot of people were starstruck.
They talked to them about it?
They had talked to my parents about it, because oh. I portray my parents. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's pretty intense stuff. It's about my parents' survivals through the genocide in Cambodia, and it's very personal. So the entire school and these other parents had already met my parents in some way. And so when they came into town for graduation, they kept asking my parents, oh my gosh, do you know about this piece? Why weren't you here? Blah, 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 blah. And my parents were sort of, they were dumbfounded by the whole experience, because previously they had not known about the play.
Okay.
So it was a bit of a surprise.
Okay.
And so then I had to talk to my parents about what the play was about and whatnot. And I had thought about bringing them to this production when it was done in New York. But I don't think I'm ready yet. It scares me.
I understand that.
Yeah, it's totally terrifying, because I think when it's a story that is dealing with the truth, or some of the truth, mostly the truth, and it's a theatrical venture, there's this constant struggle of being true to what happened and then also theatricalizing it in a way that makes sense. And so I had a really difficult time trying to find that balance. Ultimately, I think it's very authentic, but I would worry about the experience of my parents watching it and trying to navigate this experience of watching their son portray them.
Right.
Hopefully.
And part of their story being in front of an audience.
Yeah. I think it in an idea exists, and it's fine, and it seems like a great idea, but I think that the actual event of having me enacting my parents in front of my parents is like, whoa, it's perhaps too much. But I also think that that's also because I haven't totally unlocked the play completely. And I think when I do feel really kind of right about the play, I think there will be no question whether or not my parents can come. So it'll happen, I think.
Staying on that topic, how have they accepted you as an actor? Bigger than that solo show, but like throughout your time being an actor, what has your family kind of made of it? Are they confused?
Well, they're terribly confused.
Yeah.
I don't think they're terribly confused. I think that they have lots of questions. I think it still stands as a mystery to them. I think like most of our parents, we think of actors as people who are on our TVs.
Right.
Or in our movie theaters.
And any other version is kind of...
Yeah.
Really?
What? Yeah. Like the questions are always... When are you going to be in a movie? When are you going to be in a TV show?
Because they know what that is.
Exactly. And they relate to that. They understand that. Yeah. And that means success to them if you're going to do this thing called acting. And it's hard to express to them for every Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, there are 1,000 more actors who are not doing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've had a hard time trying to convey what I'm doing to them. I think that they have very old school values.
Mm-hmm.
They want me to be an engineer and to make lots of money. And
this sounds like my dad.
To buy a house and to have kids. And that is your kind of expression of a life. And I think it is still taking me time to figure out that isn't my expression of what a life should be for myself. And, I mean, they were totally, so I went out to St. Louis and I did my first regional gig doing Twelfth Night and they put me up in a hotel like you're supposed to, or an apartment like you're supposed to do, as you know, sanctioned by Actors Equity as our like our union. And I told my parents, maybe you should come out and see me in the show. And my parents up to this point had not seen anything I had done in undergrad or graduate school.
Really? I didn't know that.
It was
they had never come to Evansville?
Yeah, never. This was the first... they came to Evansville, but they hadn't seen any performances. So the last time they had seen me perform was when I was 18 years old.
Wow.
And they came out to St. Louis and saw me in Twelfth Night, and they saw that I had been given a car to drive around. I'd been given an apartment. And I think that was the first time a light bulb went on. And I think they really saw me as somebody that was being supported to do this thing that
and respected.
That was respected enough to be given these amenities or whatnot. And so that for me was a moment where I felt like I communicated to them what this career is. And so I was pretty proud of that moment.
Yeah.
And I think they were proud as well. So
it's so different from what so many of our parents do. It's so different. And to us, it's just everyone we know does it. So it's
Well, and the
norm. But
it is, And you get excited about the fact, oh, I got a regional gig. Great. I can go out of town for a little bit and do
but
the show.
But it's like a foreign world.
Yeah. The first question is, are you going to leave your day job? And
it's not as simple as that.
Yeah. It's not quite black and white as they want it to be.
Can you talk a little bit about your day job that you have right now and how that's been as an actor?
Yeah, I work at this company called iTheatrics, and they work with the different licensing musical theater companies. And we essentially create the educational versions of musicals. And I got hired on just by luck, chance, as a proofreader for them. Because we do a lot of writing of resources for schools to do musicals. And so I just came on as a proofreader, as an editor, and then I just kind of stuck around, and I think we vibed really well, and I was able to use my education for the first time in a day job. You know, I think that's always the struggle, finding a day job that supports you or allows you to do your thing, your actual work. And I've wrestled with this question a lot, because part of me feels like, why don't I just get a job where I can just turn off and just kind of flail my arms and just
not care about it at all.
And I've done that before, and I found it to be, I'm also somebody who really worries about wasting time. Yeah. And worries about not using my brain, or worries about not using the education that I have, that I've earned. And so waiting tables was not going to work for me. Also, I have a really low threshold for bullshit. So if somebody like cares about their food, I don't care.
It doesn't work.
So doing a job where I was able to use my education and it was the same vocabulary was really valuable to me. And also the company itself, the people in the company are uber supportive of me, and they know where my heart is. So they understand that, and there's a kind of dance we do, which I love this dance we do, because it does allow me to continue to do what I need to do and not fret about the financial stuff as much.
Right. So when you got the gig to go to Humana, they were with giving you the time off.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They said, bye, girl, bye. And I said, okay. Yeah, it was great. It was, you know, I've gone out of town for a couple of things, and each time they've said, okay.
That's wonderful.
And they've always said to me, you can come back whenever you're back. And I think that is great. As an artist in this city,
I'm sure it has its like tedious moments and its downsides at times, but that's really wonderful.
For sure. And also they have a rehearsal space, which has been so helpful.
I mean, I wasn't going to mention it, but
it sounds like I'm advertising it.
a certain production we rehearsed there. It was lovely.
No, truly. It's really, I mean, as somebody who auditions for whatever, it's like having a space that is a studio that you can actually focus in has been very helpful. So the workplace has been really kind of great for me. I don't think I could have done the things that I've done without them as well. So I value that a lot.
Is there any, like when you're trying not to go to the dark side, are there any tools that you turn to time and time again? Books that you read, or music that you listen to, or places that you go?
There's so many places. I am a wanderer of New York City.
I love this city, and I love to hear what other people
are drawn to
about it.
Yeah, for sure. I'm trying to go through my list of places. Churches. I sit in churches a lot. I used to be a very spiritual person. I am still spiritual, but I think the stark contrast of the craziness of New York City and stepping inside a church is a life preserver for me. And you can always count on a church to be so utterly quiet.
Yeah.
That you can actually hear your own thoughts without having to worry about walking at the speed of traffic and running to whatever.
That makes me think of how we used to have our late night meetups in the chapel at Evansville.
Oh yeah. Our Dead Poet Society.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
But in New York City, you're right, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it is. It's a refuge, and I wouldn't be alive if I wouldn't be able to go into a church and just sit for a little bit. I also love coffee shops. I love the kind of the feel, the idea of people communing in these kind of social spaces and drinking a latte and eating a pastry. I there's something about it that always feels really warm to me.
Have you ever read A Movable Feast by Hemingway?
No.
It's kind of like a journal of his time in Paris. And he just talks about going to the cafes and, you know, nursing a little aperitif all day and writing and having no money and walking around and like feeding off of the architecture and the art and like rationing what food he could get.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel that way about cafes and coffee shops, like where they used to be.
There's actually this
an artist's realm.
Yeah, there's this one spot, the Hungarian
bakery. That's what I was about to say.
At 110th
in Amsterdam.
Yeah, I just got introduced to it recently. Hungarian pastry shop. Yeah. And it was the first coffee shop where I felt like it wasn't some sort of affect or some weird Brooklyn night coffee shop.
No, that is really in that vein.
Yeah, it felt like it felt very old school. It felt very a place that wasn't trying to be anything else besides what it was. There's an overpopulation of tables, and you're forced to sit with other people, and that sort of encourages you to commune. And I've found that place to be really lovely.
I lived on 103rd for a year, and that place was my office, as Frank used to call it. And I really miss it because I'm not in that area very much anymore, but it's bottomless coffee.
Yeah.
No music, no Wi-Fi, bunch of Columbia students studying. It's the best. And
there's also like such a range of people. Yeah. The demographic for that place is pretty wide. There are a lot of older people who go there as well, which I think is really great because it feels, you know, like what a coffee shop used to be in some ways, where people just like hung out and talked about ideas.
I'm so glad you mentioned that place. Yeah.
And parks, of course. Mm-hmm. Parks are really special to me. Nature, like breathing oxygen, real oxygen, is very helpful to me. Bookshops too. Strand bookshop. Mm-hmm. I really love the Strand, even though it's crazy in there. There is something about just like surrounding yourself with literature that is very peaceful.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about the group lab.
The group lab. Yes. Which
I know is a theater company that you were part of starting with a lot of our Evansville friends, but can you talk a little bit about how you guys started it or how it's been for you to have like a theater home with other peers or colleagues?
For sure. So, you know, in undergrad and graduate school, you have these communities, and every time you do a play, you have this community, and it feels so great. And then you're ejected from that, and you go, I need people. And I think that's the joy of being a theater artist, artist in general, is that you feed off the connection. And so, I guess it was the November, I remember this because it was the month of my birthday, the November after graduate school, my last year of graduate school, I just felt this impulse to gather people and say, let's sit in a room and do something. And so the first thing we did was a reading of The Seagull, Chekhov's The Seagull. And also selfishly, because I love that play and I've wanted to read it out loud and play Constantine and whatnot. But I really just wanted to get in a room with people and just read this play and convene. And at first it began as a sort of bring something to the group lab and we'll read it. And we met pretty frequently, and some people left and some people stuck around. And the people who stuck around became the group lab. And there was no kind of guiding principle for the company. And I think that's something we all struggle with now. Mm-hmm. There are 9 members, and we have had many a conversation about what is the overarching theme or principle for work that we do. And I think a lot of young theater companies have a certain pressure to figure that out. And I think that we've sort of relieved ourselves of that pressure.
Have a niche.
Yeah,
stick
have
to
a
that,
niche.
Or a theme. Or a...
Because also we didn't feel a responsibility to produce. We just felt a responsibility to one another and to doing the things that we wanted to do, collaborating on the things that we wanted to do. So, you know, we've done like a myriad of different things. We've worked on new plays. We've done workshops of new plays. We've done readings of those things. We've also done crazy things. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about these things, but I'm totally going to. You know, we've thrown unbirthday parties for people.
Okay.
Which is like a specialized celebration for specific people.
Aww.
We've done this project called The Ware Project, which is a storytelling-based project where storytellers are invited to respond to the questions, where are you from and where are you going, in an original creative way. And that, it's crazy. We're in our 5th iteration of this project, and it's been sort of a really transcendent, lovely thing that's kind of happened.
Yeah, I've loved seeing it evolve.
Yeah, it's really cool, and it keeps changing, which is cool. And then we just did, you know, the production of one of the group lab members, Emily Kitchen's play, Raft. It was produced at 59 East 59th and then done at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. And so it's like everything's percolating, and we're building stuff, we're working on stuff. And I think what is really helpful is that we don't feel the pressure to produce.
Right.
We just kind of follow our impulses. And
but you still have a sounding board. Like if you have a creative home.
For sure.
To bounce ideas off of, yeah. Or to depend on.
Yeah, and it's great because it does feel like an artistic home. We actually had a meeting last night. We met at Le Pain Quotidien. And we were just like drinking lattes and talking and talking about this next Ware project, and also just checking in and making sure everybody was okay. And I think that, you talk about the dark side, you know, it's having people that you can do that around a table with is so terribly necessary and helpful to know you have a home to come back to. A home of people that love you, and you know that.
Is there anything you've seen recently that you'd like to recommend?
Oh
my God. That's been inspiring to you?
This is going to be ridiculous. Not ridiculous. It's going to be obvious, but I saw Hamilton.
Yes.
I saw Hamilton, and I lost my goddamn mind.
Yes.
I cried.
I cried my eyes out.
It was so exceptionally... It's a moment. No, it's not even... It's not a moment. It's a movement. It's... You know, for me... I hope I'm not talking too much.
No, go. Because I am on this bandwagon with you.
No, for me, as a person of color, as an artist, and watching a historical play about the founding of America... Watching just like the beginning. Oh, I can't even ruin it for people, but seeing people of color just sort of grab hold to this really complicated history where those people are oppressed, and at the same time saying, no, this is my history as an American and I'm owning it. I can't tell you how much that moved me, because I feel like in this world, in this business, in this art, it often feels like there are these rules that you don't, you know, don't not follow.
Yeah.
You stay in line and you kind of create within your niche.
And you're only allowed to tell these stories.
Exactly. And it was this kind of like my heart, my bones, everything just opened up because I felt like truly, and I know this is so terribly idealistic, but I truly felt like anything was possible in art from watching that show.
Yeah.
And I have told this to many people. If there is one show that you should spend money on, it is this show. It is. And I also think there's something special about watching these people who created the show do it, be at the center of the narrative. It is exceptional.
It's beautiful.
It's on so many levels. It's fun. It's so entertaining.
It's just breaking the mold on so many, so many different planes.
Oh my God. It is awesome. And I'm trying so to figure out when to see it again.
I know. I'm spoiled. I already saw it twice, but I want to see it more.
It's pretty awesome.
Oh, good.
I'm trying to think of other stuff. I saw The Christians recently.
Oh, I haven't seen that, but people keep mentioning it to me.
Yeah, I saw The Christians at Playwrights Horizons, and I definitely recommend that show. I think we're politically in a very specific, scary time.
Hmm. I don't know anything about what it deals with, although obviously the title tells you something.
Yeah, it's about religion, and it's about how we our relationship to religion and what is our relationship to religion and then our relationship to other people as human beings, our interpersonal relationships, and the kind of collision of those two things when you believe something so strongly within your faith and then you also have to deal with people, other people, humanity, like what you're willing to sacrifice. And I think, I had an interesting conversation last night with my friend Kyle. And I think we had this really interesting back and forth about whether or not you have to be a person of some sort of religious background to be affected by the play. But I think ultimately it's just about yourself in relationship to other people. I think that's ultimately what that story is about. I think it's a pretty awesome story.
I gotta see it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks a lot.
So glad to have you here.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller. Music by Brendan Spieth. Audio assistance from Nick Choksi. And a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.